My name is Darius Larson. The title of this session is Spirituality of Civility, Know Your Enemies. Did I do that right? Last night, how many of you were here last night? Okay, just a quick review then. Last night we took a look at how culture seems to split facts and values with some sort of dividing wall that keeps us thinking of facts as the public domain and values and beliefs as kind of a private domain, things that we just talk about in the intimacy of our own home, in our backyard patio, or with people who are of like mind. And what happens with this is that we end up stifling any sort of chance on dealing with, I think, moral issues that really matter, because it's very hard to separate facts and values, especially about moral issues. And we got talking, and I think I want to pick it up almost this morning with the discussion on both, Walt, some of your comments last night and some comments I had with three other people after the session. And it's basically dealing with the question of how do you get back up on the horse after you have fallen off of it? What happens in moral conversations, like what it must have been like with the Missouri Synod and Seminex struggles? What must it be like when you've had a hard-fought fight in an annual meeting and somehow you become vulnerable, you risk being who you think is yourself with all good intentions, what you think is what God is calling you to be and act at that moment, and you find yourself either shut up or on the losing side, or you just feel darn right hurt and you say, this isn't what the church is meant to be. And have any of you felt that way in church meetings before, in church structures? I mean, am I touching on a nerve here that might have some relevancy to our discussion? What do we do about it? One comment about it that I wanted to get to last night and I didn't get to, that I might just say to set this up and then ask that question again, is that the human sexuality statement that many of us mentioned last night talked about, if you take this value split, fact value split, it talked about a very private thing in a very public way. And we don't have any mechanism on how to do that. And the church does a pretty good job laying out statements on abortion, statements on peacemaking, statements on human sexuality, but they don't lay out a method for how we should go about digesting these things and talking about these things. And I think we really need to develop such a method, and hopefully the one that will be discussed on Friday might be one such method, because most of the other methods that I see operating in churches today do not work, especially when you touch deep convictions. As somebody says, it almost is like you are grabbed in the private parts and your ego is at stake, and what do you do? So my question, and if you've had any further reflections on it before I get going on the topic of knowing your enemies, is what does one do when one falls off the horse in order to find the energy to get back up on the horse and try again? Yeah?
Well, for Christians, theoretically, being disciples of Christ, we should imitate Christ and ask the question, would Jesus do here when they try to do it? We will fail some of the time, but we will have success some of the time. And, you know, so going into the Gospels and saying, okay, well, if Jesus were here, he would reject the enmity. He would be forgiving. He would, I'm sure, just in my conception of what Jesus would do, who knows exactly what, but I think all of us would know that he's the gentle peacemaker, the arbiter, the reconciliator, a nonviolent Jesus would do something gentle and compassionate and merciful and forgiving. And we would say, let's listen to all sides. Let's try not to get angry. Definitely no hatred. No. It says in 1 John 4:20, if you say you love Jesus but hate your brother or sister, you are a liar. Follow the hatred. Love the enemy. Do good to those who are opposing you. And do the reconciling stuff. Now, we are nurtured in that process in most churches. And the times that I have proposed that I've been in annual meetings and says, okay, what would Jesus do here? Now, I get this dull look that I can say, what, are you some proponent of this purest gospel or what? It just doesn't make any sense. So I don't think we're nurtured in peacemaking. We're not nurtured in reconciling with Christ. We don't really believe, you know, what Paul said, that there's neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, black nor white, gay nor straight, but all are one in Christ. I don't think we really trust that. We don't believe that. We have our own agendas. We want to see that we're the winner instead of the reconciler. That's probably idealistic, but, you know, if Jesus, who was God on earth, said it, can it be impractical? If we put the effort into it, can what Jesus said be impractical about violence?
Well,
I believe it. That's correct.
Yeah.
If the question is, what would Jesus do? One also has an incident in Mark chapter 3 in which Jesus became very angry. Of course, anger is not the same thing as hatred.
That's right.
Very angry.
That's right.
And the Gospels show that he tried by one device or another, multiple devices, in which to, if I may put it this way, instruct the opposition, and stereotypically that's the Pharisees. And there comes a time when he finally pronounces, at least in Matthew 2 chapters, with the wolves. I mean, I don't want to detract from the idea that Jesus is not going to use physical violence and so on, that sort of thing. But when you say, you know, he's loving and accepting and forgiving, there are some things he does not accept. Some things. You know, there are some things, and if he's forgiving, then he always forgives sins. And I don't think accepting and forgiving are synonyms. But there is this sterner side to what Jesus does, and he rebukes. He doesn't simply accept everything. And I agree with you that Jesus did not use physical violence.
And then there's a point that it'd be one thing if I was Jesus, but if I'm laying down on the floor or on the road after somebody has kicked me off, and I'm feeling incredibly vulnerable, and if I'm feeling hurt emotionally, psychologically, and maybe even physically, the Christ-like thing is to get back up on the horse, I guess, and be kicked, you know, turn the other cheek, you know, be kicked back down again. I usually run for cover for a while to get recharged. I think that's a natural instinct. Two synod conventions ago, we had in the Southwestern Minnesota Synod two resolutions dealing with the human sexuality first draft. And they were both, in my opinion, terrible statements, condemning the whole thing, stating how evil it was, and just it just went on and on, very polemical. And I thought, well, what should we do? Got a bunch of pastors together and some other lay delegates, and we decided to submit a substitute resolution for them, dealing with much of what I thought I was trying to get at last night. Dealing with that, is the church large enough to have a diversity of viewpoints within itself that we can continue to discuss these major issues? Or are we saying that the church is not large enough? And as one person said in the debate, that we must take a stand somewhere about something, and this is where we're taking the stand. This is where we're drawing the line in the sand. My resolution was indefinitely tabled as a parliamentary action, and the other ones came on, and one was defeated, and one was amended to be a little more softened. But, you know, it left me thinking, because I was sincere, I thought, that the intent was, can we be civil enough and broad enough in our thinking that the church is large enough to have diverse groups of opinions within it? And I think our church, the ELCA, is coming to question that very, very substantially, similar to what I think the Missouri Synod has done on other issues in the past, and questioning. And how do we live in the meantime? I'll never forget meeting Sister Margaret. I think she was a Sister of Charity in Mexico City. Her job was to minister to the people who lived in the city dump. Now, the city dump in Mexico City runs, it's about, I don't know, what is it, about 4 miles by 10 miles or something, a huge area. And some of these people have been living there for 3-4 generations. And all they see is this rubbish pile, and they have these cardboard, or if they're lucky, tin shacks that they live in, and they scrounge around this dump finding things to eat and to feed on. And I asked her, what keeps you going? I mean, if I would be doing that, I think I could do it for a day, maybe a week. Feel pretty good about it, like I have to do on Friday in the Holden dump, garbology on Friday. And I says, doesn't it just drain you? And kind of like a Mother Teresa type, she says, oh no, it feeds me. These are people who need to know the love of Christ. And I said, boy, do I have a lot to learn. So sometimes when I'm at synod conventions, I think of this woman and I say, you know, maybe they need and I need to know the love of Christ. John Nelson, who some of you know from First Lutheran Central Lutheran, Central First, man, the one downtown. Somebody once asked him about his peacemaking days, that things are just getting worse and worse, and you've been working at this so long and hard. I mean, there's 10 steps backwards for every one step forward. You're losing ground. How do you keep doing it? Why do you do it? And John, without missing a beat, said, well, I know how the story ends. I mean, he's the only guy that I know that can get us cool campus pastors to get together in the airport in Minneapolis before he flew back at a staff conference to spend another term in jail over something, to form a prayer circle, hold hands and pray out loud for him before he would hop on the plane and take off back off for Seattle. He deeply believes and is committed, as Sister Margaret was, to the gospel of Jesus Christ as a radical change agent in this world. And if we can believe that, most of the time, we can get back up on that horse again and again and again. Now the problem comes, there are some horses that we think we're getting back up on, which is the horse of Christ. And it's the other principalities and powers. And what we need is that discernment to know that if what it is that I think I'm proclaiming as the gospel truth could be nothing else but maybe the Antichrist or something in between those two extremes. Any other thoughts on this that any of you might have?
The second question that I think Christians always need to ponder in making day-to-day decisions, besides what would Jesus do here and not try to do it, is how can I relieve the human suffering and then try to do it? When there is suffering going on, we as Christians, as Americans, as an example, how can we go to the enemy if he's suffering, or a friend or the neighbor or whatever, whether it's mental anguish, whether it's someone who's on the opposite side of your viewpoint in church, they're tormented, you know. Bald Bowman is tormented by certain chains here. We should be rushing to him and say, well, you know, you're suffering. And he's not the only one. He expressed it the best. We need to be, as Christians, unconditional in our mercy, unconditional in our love. And that's how we unify the church. Mm-hmm. Right. Reject enmity. Relieve suffering. Do the unconditional act of Christ-like love on a day-to-day, minute-to-minute basis. And then we will know Christ, we will know God, we will be moving towards the kingdom of the Lamb.
In fact, that's another thing John Nelson said. I know how the story ends. The lion does lie down with the lamb. And it's not like Woody Allen. You ever heard of him? Ha, lying down is nothing. It's getting up that counts. We will be having, in case some of you don't know, at 11:02, it will be a bell will ring, and we will have a couple moments of silence, because that is the time that the second bomb was dropped, this time on Nagasaki. And so at that time, we will just, wherever we are in our discussion, we will just pause and reflect and pray and wonder about how life has changed because of that event. But until that time, I assume most of you, yesterday I think all of you were members of some church. Is that kind of the same here today? That some of you are members somewhere. I wanna start looking at some issues that I can hopefully use on Saturday morning to actually model the model I'm gonna be laying out on Friday. And so what I want to ask you is, what issues in your parish do you think at this time seems to be cutting your parish apart? Are there some issues? Yeah.
I don't think this has come to the point that it's cutting us apart, but we're in the call process right now. And our community outside Chicago is it's an older, historic sort of community, and it's starting to change in that different people of different races are coming into it, and the gay population is growing, and we feel that we want to be reflective of our community, but right now we're not. And we, especially on the call committee, are struggling with the type of pastor that we should call that would help us to do that. And some of these things, I think, we like to think we're a fairly progressive community, but when it comes down to how diverse are we really going to become in our church, we may run into some strong feelings from some people.
And yet, yes, yet you don't know that, but you fear that.
Right.
Or do you know that as well?
Well, no, I guess we don't know that, but we have a strong sense of it.
Any others?
Well, I know in our church, and even like the abortion issue is not a real comfortable issue.
How has that?
I don't know how it's affected the congregation, but I know that there's a feeling of being accepted or rejected by certain people, depending on your opinion.
Mm-hmm. How about at Old Holden here? If you think of Holdenites, all of us gathered here as a community, what things have you been hearing, perceiving, and thinking that, what murmuring have you been hearing that might be that might be a good controversial issue that we can touch upon maybe on Saturday?
Last evening, in the Vesper service, in the evening prayer, among the intercessions in which we were led was a prayer for various kinds of people, and then also for partners and others, with a very conspicuous omission of spouses, as though partners were simply a more generic, presumably more inclusive term, but also included spouses, but which very obvious, but let's put it this way, but which in the mind, in my mind, would very obviously exclude spouses, because to be a spouse is other than to be a partner. I don't want to read any malign motives, but given the language sensitivity that is so strongly cultivated here, and if one begins to put out the antennae, the necessary antennae, to see what's being said, that was a very striking omission. Whether deliberate or not, I'm not in a position to say.
Sure, sure.
I would add to that, the same thing happened on Sunday night, and I think that's what I missed. I had a similar reaction on Sunday night. In the prayers, there was a prayer for people who were in covenanted relationships.
Well, that's the one, yes.
And,
those who have promised.
Yes.
In the covenant promise.
And I had, basically you spoke of what I was thinking. And I would add to that God language, which I think is certainly not unique to Holden.
Mm-hmm.
I think last week the God language was more of an issue. We talked about the reimagining conference. We had two or three sessions. From people that have been at the reimagining. So I think that was an issue that came up last week.
And it was basically out of the reimagining that the God language question, or there some.
I don't know if it was out of that, but I mean that was a part of the mix.
Yeah, I guess that's the only time I heard it, but it had been discussed. I think it had been discussed before. During the week.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand what the quote unquote God language. What is it? Addressing, what my take on was addressing God as mother as well as father.
That's what they did or didn't do.
Well, it's been done here at Holden.
Right. I assume at the reimagining conference, I don't know if they did or did not use the word father. I know at Holden the issue is not to is to be more expansive with our language. It's not to say that we don't use the word father, but we have to, so to speak, break open the metaphor and allow us to use multiple different names for God. And the other side, or a strong side, says, but the true name for God is the triune name for God, which is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so that if you don't name God that, you're naming a different God than that. And at least that's how I understand some of the debate, which we have dealt with in our congregation too.
Well, it's probably, a little stronger than that, Darius.
Okay.
The name is not simply what we name God. The name is what God, how he has revealed himself to us. And and the difficulty that I have with what is called inclusive language, and some of the rationale that supports different names for God, is that it does not draw a sufficiently strong distinction, a very necessary distinction, between the name of God by which God has revealed himself to us, and metaphors by which we try to describe, imagine, or speak of God.
Okay. Well, I think we have one potential issue right here as I'm hearing us talk that I don't want to get into it now, but I wanted to find an issue that we might want to get into, so that might be very, very good.
Good question here.
Oh, sure.
A church which I just recently left has a problem, and I don't know how they're going to solve it. My husband worked in a committee for a while before he got sick. There was two pastors and one of the pastors simply is not pulling his load. And there is lots and lots of murmurs. You know, he doesn't do this, he doesn't do that, he doesn't do this, you know. He's not visible. When he is visible, he's standing with a coffee cup in his hand or one of his children in his arms, and instead of greeting people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But they just don't know what to do about it. And I have been away from the church, like when I say, and I've been away from that church now for a year. And I talked to someone last week, and I said, what has happened with the pastor? And he said, nothing. The situation is still the same. And so I think that is, and everyone is afraid, you see.
Sure.
To really say, look, you're not doing what you've been commissioned to do. It's really, really a touchy situation when you're trying to go after a pastor.
Because we want to be so nice.
Right.
We want to do, we deeply want to do the right thing.
Has it divided the group? Is there a group?
Well, for him or? A little. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's two pastors?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think what my husband was trying to get at was one is called a senior pastor. So it's up to him to guide this other person along. But he's not that kind of a, you know, he just doesn't have that ability to do that. And some of us thought that he even liked it this way, because then he could do what he wanted to do, you know. He could do his thing on here and just let the other one just...
Interesting.
Do you have a regional ministry committee? There's a parish support committee, and that's what my husband was serving on, trying to bring him in and talking about certain things and that, but... Oh boy, it was really, really touching.
Is there not a structure within, in the church that you can go outside to, you know, if you have a problem with your, in the New Testament, this is if you have a problem with one person, you talk to them, and then you go to two or three together, and then you go to the authority or the person.
You mean like the district or something like that? I just think this committee, yes, there would be, but I mean this committee kind of disintegrated. My husband had to leave it, and no one else has just really felt strong enough.
Or a personnel committee that would look at each person's job within the whole staff and then look at their job description.
But the natural tendency is to put our heads in the sand and just want the problem to go away. And this church probably is the type of church that they will continue to do that until it festers so much that it breaks out into incredibly unhealthy ways. Because they don't know how to attack it, they don't know how to deal with it, they don't know, because they don't have these other networks placed in mind.
Somebody needs to go to your bishop's assistant. Like, we have two full-time pastors, and we don't have, I'm not we anymore, but they don't have any special program going. No search, no Bethel, no disciple, you know, nothing going. Because, well, first of all, someone had said, well, just tell him he has to do it. Someone else said yes, but if he did, nobody would sign up. Because they know what a poor teacher, you know.
Yeah.
So
and that's why it's important for your congregation in this call process to really know what you want, and you'll always be surprised.
Well, I think we've defined what we want. Right? Yeah. We're pretty sure we're...
That you're
on the right horse.
Yeah, on the right horse. You know, the one problem I have many problems, one of the problems I have in life is I cannot stand narrow-minded people. And then the problem is, once I make that statement, I become that which I can't stand. I become that narrow-minded person. And somehow when you set up moral conversations and we're looking for some openness, inclusivity, we're almost doomed to failure because if somebody, well, let's pause for a moment of prayer. Was he going to ring the bell again when it's over? We'll give it 2 minutes.
They were just
talking. Let us pause and reflect upon this day at 11:02 when the second bomb was dropped. How long, oh Lord, how long? I was wondering, are they just going to give us a couple minutes and then ring the bell to end? I says, well, I'll give it 2 minutes and then I'll continue. And I was figuring that, so. Yeah, but it is interesting how somebody, what's this thing with the bell? You're going, you know, I wonder how many, this day, I wonder how many people said, you know, what's this thing, we dropped another one? And, you know, what's going on here? And then how the reality of that just permeates whatever we're doing, how we cannot shut that bell off because every kid wants two poles. But we can shut the windows. No.
Yeah. Bell's nice.
I like the bell. I do. Yeah, bowels are much nicer than bombs. I agree. I can't stand narrow-minded people. And once I make that statement, I become that which I cannot stand, narrow-minded. And as one person who said to me once that, you know, the problem with inclusivity is that it's exclusive to those people who feel like they don't want to be inclusive. So if you really are about inclusivity, you must state, I mean, how can you accept people who don't want to accept that? You know, and it's not as easy. Yeah?
I have to disagree with that a little bit.
Oh, I totally disagree, but go ahead, tell me why.
Well, the thing is that, you know, I was thinking you're asking, is there room in the church for people with these, you know, very different viewpoints take homosexuality? Okay, well, why are you going to pick a black and white issue that some people are going to feel very passionately is very wrong according to scripture, and other people are going to feel that, you know, where are you going to pick an issue like that and try to get some kind of consensus? Nobody's going to reach consensus. And both sides feel that they are morally self-righteous.
Mm-hmm.
And why not get that group together and talk about their problem of being morally self-righteous? And I've encountered that at Holden lots of different times when I've been here too, that, you know, if I don't want, you know, to use the inclusive language that's here or something that, you know, somehow if I'm going to be a champion of a victim group, then I'm self-righteous and a good person and, you know, all that kind of stuff where, you know, if sometimes when I've been here with old folks from the Midwest, it's just too much of a stretch for them. They've been praying Our Father, you know, and all those words for, you know, 80 years. You know, why are you going to say to them, you have to learn to say Abba Emma, or you have to, I mean, this year is the first year I've been here where they've said, pray whatever you want to say, instead of saying, pray Abba Emma, you know, and so, I don't know, I want to be inclusive, I want to love people, like Jesus taught us to love everybody, love our enemies and all of that, but I also feel that people need to be passionate, Jesus wanted us to be passionate. And that sometimes when you try to have the consensus and the peacemaking, all this kind of stuff, what you're asking people to be is not honest about their passions. And, you know, I think I can accept that somebody doesn't believe or feel the way that I do, but I do not expect that they're going to have to come part way to my viewpoint or, you know, all of that. And I don't know. There's
keep going. You're saying what I want to say much better, so keep going.
I get a lot of these messages when I'm here at Holden about that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that trying to put this new standard of, well, I don't know, I shouldn't say, you know, the civility or whatever, but there's this idea about how we're all supposed to get along that is actually, in a way, going to cause more conflict. I mean, it's part of the repressing the real conflicts and stuff that are there instead of being open and honest and having those healthy discussions, you know, that we can't come together. But the problem is that for me, a lot of times with some of these black and white issues, people are championing them to be self-righteous, you know, to be, you know, not a perpetrator, but a rescuer, I guess. And I think there's a lot of confusion about that in some of the things that in our church.
Sure.
Two questions I have. One that I've been wanting to ask you for a while. You were saying, how can we, when we're engaged in moral discourse, bring people together who have very passionate feelings one side or another? And my question is, I am yet I would like to hear what constitutes moral discourse as distinguished, let us say, from what political discourse or psychological discourse, or what constitutes moral discourse? What is its appropriate specific character to make it moral discourse? And because I think that's terribly important. Now when Ginger Hooker speaks, I think many of us resonate to her too, and I think that there is a kind of a tendency to use the word self-righteous, maybe a little bit prematurely, because I don't know whether it's simply a question of saying this is the way I feel, and that's the way you feel, and is there a way of trying to mediate between the way you feel and I feel? Because I think at its deepest and at its best, I want to say what I need to say, not because I feel that way, but because finally, what's at stake is maybe better called faithfulness. I would hate to think of, let us say, Gary here, that's just your particular passion, we gotta sort of tolerate that. I mean, there's a sense in which he would rightfully resist that kind of characterization, because I'm confident that in his own self-understanding, he is attempting to be faithful, and in that rather single-minded faithfulness, it comes with guilt and grace for me to call him self-righteous, simply because he's pursuing his thing. In other words, if the category of faithfulness is one that is licit here, then is there not a proper time when we have to ask the question, what is it that we're trying to be faithful to? Because so often when I hear the category of inclusivity, that's beyond moral discourse already. That's already the desideratum. Is it? Is that so desirable? Is that beyond question itself? Or is that too a part of the moral discourse? But I'd like to come back to you, Darius, and I'd like to have you clarify what it is that you mean by moral discourse.
Well, discourse, or what I would like to say is conversation. Moral conversation is talking about things that we believe or have feelings deeply about, as far as what is right and what is wrong. You know, in a conversational way in which we hear, a conversation is not me telling you what to think. A conversation is a two or a three or a four or a five-way street. So moral discourse or moral conversation is trying to have a dialogue about issues that we feel deeply and passionately about, in which we have some conviction about what is right about it and what is wrong about it. It is not about pluralism in my book. It is not about accepting everything out there as equal. It's about listening to what other people may think should be included and being open to think that maybe it should. But at the same time, having my own convictions, having my own opinions, or having the opinions that I think God wants me to have. Is that how, I mean, and that's what half an hour ago I thought I was going to get into talking about as far as the topic for the day, that there is such things as enemies. Love your enemies amidst that there's such a thing as enemies. And we all too often say, oh, we're not supposed to have any enemies. We're not supposed to have any other people out there. We're supposed to live in this kind of harmonious, blissful kind of relationship where we should stuff any deeply felt passion about anything. And what I'm saying is that's our problem. Modernity has caused us to think in such rampant individualistic ways that the story, as Stanley Horowitz said, if I can find it here, is that modernity was to produce people who believe that they should have no story except the story they chose when they had no story. And Horowitz says, such a story, and this is what scares the heck out of me, but I think it's right on. Such a story is called the story of freedom. That story and the institutions that embody it is the enemy, he says, the enemy that we must attack. Because the gospel, and this is all from Horowitz, the gospel is not a part of the world. But the world is part of the gospel. And we sometimes in our society here, and I wish I would have this clearer in my head, but I just read this a week ago at Dan Erlander's, and I might just say it was in a magazine called First Things, Newhouse's magazine, which, you know, it's kind of like watching TV. I don't really watch TV, but, you know, that kind of story. In fact, I said, Dan, do you subscribe to this? He says, oh, no, it was just given to me. Okay, I think I might. I've been reading, Holden has it here. And there's some good... There's some good stuff in there, you know. Some of my best friends know. but Michael, who's talking next door here, talked about postmodernity as a time in which we have lost our orientation. That we no longer think we as human beings, as rugged individualists, can choose our story, because there's no story to choose. And that we must, our only option is to be indifferent to life. And that maybe we're not able to choose any options. And that's the scary thing now in postmodernity. It's like having so many compact discs to choose from that you choose a compact disc, and upon choosing it, you worry about if it was the right choice. Or houses. We just bought a house. I love that house. And as soon as we finally made the purchase, I wondered, what if a better one would come along? Car selections, computers, you name all those choices out there. It's driving us, I think, nuts, like these pages that are all confused here for me now. Southern Baptists, one thing I like about them is that they know how to fight in public. Is it true? I mean, the Lutheran Church, we cry foul play. We blame it on the media, some sort of leak that causes all this problem, and then we run for cover. Fundamentalists at least believe that it's okay to have a strong view. They even believe that they are supposed to act on their convictions. I'm afraid our Lutheran church, meaning I'm a Lutheran, and maybe not all of you are. I'll say the problem with mainline churches is that we don't even know how to join an argument. We want to create a committee to study the issue. And if postmodernism means anything, it means that the comforting illusion of modernity, this is Horowitz again, that told us that conflict is, can be, and should be avoided, is over. Our difficulty is not that we have conflicts, but that as modern people, we have not had the courage to force the conflicts we ought to have had. One hopes that God is using this time to remind the church that Christianity is unintelligible without enemies. In fact, Horowitz suggests that the whole point of Christianity is to produce the right kind of enemies. When Caesar became a member of the church, the enemy became internalized. And today we need to have a sense of where the battle is and what the stakes are and what the long-term strategy might be. And I think it's sometimes very difficult to do that.
If we have an enemy, though, does that imply we're at war?
Yes!
And I thought we just have 2 minutes of silence for peace.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I'm confused.
Well, I know how the story ends. But the story isn't over with yet.
So we've got
there are conflicts in this world.
Yeah, but conflicts doesn't mean necessarily that the other side of the conflict is an enemy, does it? Maybe I'm using the word enemy wrong, or thinking of it wrong. If I have a conflict with somebody, it's not because that person's my enemy.
No.
It's because we've got a difference of opinion. That doesn't make that person an enemy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, what's helped me, working at this and it takes an enormous amount of energy, but I think it's rejecting the enmity and rejecting the hatred. I'm still the enemy of lots of people, but I refuse to retaliate, I refuse to seek vengeance, I refuse the enmity. You may hate me, but I refuse to hate you back. You know, Martin Luther King said, we shall master our capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, we will still love you. You cannot in conscience obey your unjust laws. Non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as cooperation with good. I think that helps me, maybe I don't know if it helps you, but I'm going to reject the enmity, the hatred, and not hate back. And pretty soon, I'm not a threat to that person, and we start having a discourse, and maybe there's a chance that we actually leave a friendship. And so when we're having conflict in the church, you know, and I'm lousy at it, and within, you know, but it takes a lot of energy. But I'm not going to get down to that level of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, which Jesus clearly rejected.
I think that the word enemy is more or less reserved in, at least in my vocabulary, the word enemy tends to be something I use in the political context. If I have a disagreement with someone, or have a differing opinion with someone, or think they're out for lunch intellectually, morally, spiritually, theologically, whatever, I don't think of them as an enemy. So, I mean, I think that's at least in my own use of that word, it has very limited use.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my interactions with people, I would never think to use that word, speak of myself.
Let me pause in the illustration here. Since Gary has done us the favor of being a very outspoken pacifist and has spoken again very eloquently, presumably precisely because you feel very deeply and this is a way of being faithful, you want to transmit this to your children. And I don't doubt that with your children you have sought to teach them in the ways of peace. Supposing now I am one of the school teachers at the school to which your children attend, and I am a militant, belligerent militarist, huh? And I am going to teach these kids the right way, and I'm going to teach them that you got to go to war, and you're all going to say, of course it does. Now, will you withdraw your children from that school? Will you tell your, in all probability, you're going to say something to your children to the effect, you don't want to listen to Walt Keller because he's teaching you the wrong thing and he is misleading you, but I don't shut up, I keep at it because I feel as deeply about this as you do. I mean, I'm constructing it. Is there at some point you are going to say, Walt Keller is the enemy? He is the enemy of peace. He incarnates a wrong spirit. He is out to lunch intellectually, morally, and everything else like that. At some point, I mean, even you are going to say, you're not going to use physical violence, but you are going to call me your enemy.
Well,
I presume you would. I don't want to put a word in your mouth. But is that something, the situation that we have?
No, and before you answer that, to get at that, the problem is that we don't think we should have enemies. We stuff it, We control it. We try to do anything else but to name you as the enemy. How we deal with the enemy, Christ says, love your enemy, is a very appropriate approach to what you do when you discover who your enemy is. But in modernity and in postmodernity, what is becoming more and more clear to me is that we live under the illusion, precisely what you named, that we're not supposed to have any enemies. I mean, we're supposed to be nice to each other. I mean, civility means being nice to each other. And therefore, teach whatever you want to my child. Or you just shut up and you murmur to somebody else and everything. And that's not what it's all about. But no, go ahead, answer his question.
Well, hopefully my children have been nurtured in the rejection of enmity so well that they can handle it. But children aren't mature enough, so they are very vulnerable to, you know, somebody who is feeling, looking, and sounding very authoritative. I hope that they would be nurtured enough and know what Jesus would do enough to listen and then reject it in their own mind and not wind up, you know, in some major battle. Hopefully, I'm doing my job as a parent to have them discuss what they learn in school. It's a difficult, difficult thing. And my children were scarred at being peacemakers. And I learned more about peacemaking and pacifism from them than I thought for them. They taught me all sorts of stuff I'm learning.
Would you consider that teacher an enemy?
Well, I'm hoping that that I will have also the time or the capacity or the inclination to go and speak to the person whose views I disagree with. And the enmity is with your views, not you as a child, a fellow child of that. You know? In situations of state violence, you know, it's a truism that the enemy of the state is a child of God who is loved unconditionally by God. And if we are followers of Christ God, we are to love that individual as well. So the enemy of the state is loved by God, and we are to love them as well. It's clear. That's what Jesus says in so many words. So I don't know this, but you know, it's a very difficult situation with your kids. You know, they're so susceptible to listening, but hopefully they will be critical thinkers.
Well, I mean, but you're going to teach them.
I'm going to teach them.
You're going to say what Keller is saying is absolutely wrong.
Well,
don't want to be influenced by that guy.
Well,
and you better say that.
I'm saying, you have your strong beliefs and be a critical thinker. When you hear other views, in one ear, out the other, or see what the truth of that matter is, or find out where the position is coming from, and do that moral discourse. I think that's the moral discourse.
Here, and then I want the last 2 minutes to say something.
Well, yeah. If Christ says, love your enemy, apparently he has something in mind when he says enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is that? I mean, if he says, love your enemy, I mean, he has something definite in mind. And what is that enemy?
This may be getting around it, or it may not. It's what in the early church, the baptismal rite, in which you literally went through, at least from Ash Wednesday to the Easter Vigil, and probably for years before that, a process of exercising, naming the nose, turning west, spitting at the devil, spitting at the enemy, that the Western powers or Rome, you know, you literally, whichever way is west, and you would literally have to know that you are in battle, you are in war. There is something better than what your life was. You take off all that has been to put on the new. And so as you become clear of what that enemy is, then you go into the baptismal waters, fight with the devil, the ultimate enemy, and you come out and you say, I enter your service, O Christ. And at that point, the bishop who's been instructing you all these years kneels down and washes your feet. It gives you an illustration of what this is all about, is servanthood. At that point, maybe what enemy what you're supposed to do with enemies is love them, listen to them, converse with them, not destroy them.
But so that you can, I mean, we have a problem with saying enemy here. I mean,
yeah, right,
somehow
right,
that
right.
has...
I don't like it either.
Right. But to say enemy means that you have to define that feeling, that threat, as enemy.
Enemy means, I would say, once you say who you are against, you at least now have convictions of what you stand for. And I think all too often, we in the church don't know what we stand for or against. And to start naming, there's a danger in that, and I know most of the rhetoric in my vocabulary up until I read this darn article last week was to not to name anything the enemy. And that's why this is very raw, and it's not developed with me, and I was kind of glad that the conversation took off so I wouldn't have to struggle with it. But now I'm struggling with it again.